Monocle on Sunday is brought to you in association with Zurich Tourism.
Good morning. Guten Morgen from Zurich. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. Coming up today, my studio guests are Rob Cox, Chandra Kurt and Emily Isoaho. They're here to discuss the biggest stories this weekend. We're also off to Thailand.
I'm Gwen Robinson in Bangkok for Monocle, and I'll be trying to give you a snapshot of what's in store this week as a national strike and protests are being called.
More from Gwen in a moment. Also ahead, a check-in with what's making news on the pages of Austria's Die Presse newspaper. Plus, Monocle deputy editor Josh Fennert will bring us up to date on the news from London this morning. It's Sunday, the 11th of October, live from Duferstrasse 90 here in Zurich. This is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday with Tyler Brulé.
And good morning from a very, very sunny Zurich this morning. Rather crisp, very autumnal, I have to say. And looking the part he was looking the part when he came in. Rob Cox is here from Reuters Breaking News. You took this? Yeah, you did. Good morning. Nice to see you.
Great to be here.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit in a moment about Davos becomes Bürgenstock this year. But I'm just wondering, in your circle, in the world of course, analysis, and of course, you're no stranger to big gatherings, how's this been received so far, Rob?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, way before they moved to Lucerne and Bürgenstock, there was a sense that they were going to reduce the delegations that they were sending anyway. And there is a lot of people. Look, I mean, the World Economic Forum charges companies a lot of money to participate. And many of them in this environment, and even before COVID, were sort of questioning the value of that, right? Now, it's a fantastic venue to meet people, to do business, to see clients, all of that. It's very efficient. But I think there were a lot of people who were looking for reasons to scale back. I'm guessing that this is going to be yet another reason for them to say, okay, well, rather than putting up that $500,000 to send seven of our vice chairmen to this thing, Wall Street Bank X, Y, and Z will say, maybe this time we'll scale it back. Do a little bit less. But, you know, there's still going to be a desire to be there, to be part of this thing, to see world leaders, heads of state, CEOs want to mingle, they want to be seen there. So I'm sure it'll do fine. But I mean, if you're going from 3,000 delegates to 1,500, you know, it's just going to be a smaller affair by definition.
Intimate might be better. Yeah. Chandra Kurt is also here. Of course, wine expert, regular voice around the table. Harvests are mostly done across Europe. Have you been out and about?
I had two busy weeks traveling around Europe a little bit. I was in Italy, Austria, and also Switzerland. And the harvest is coming to an end. And, you know, there are both sides. Of course, they're happy that it's finished. The quality is, some are very happy, some are a little bit concerned because there was a lot of rain in the summer. But, of course, there is still a lot of wine in the cellars that maybe was not sold from this year. So there are different moods around.
Are people also thinking that if we look back, you know, 18 months, are 18s and 19s looking interesting for some wines already?
Of course, you know, it depends the style of the wine you drink. But I think anyway, with the global warming in our region, some areas became much better and some have to suffer a little bit.
Very good. Also, Emily Isoaho is here. He is Finnish, as you can tell by the name. Also, you notice that also Emma Nelson back in London dodged your name. She was happy to do Chandra Kurt and Rob Cox. But I think it's interesting. We're going to Thailand later. There's two probably nationalities where people sort of heart sink. Thai last names and Finnish last names are always a little bit scary when you see them on the script. Anyway, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program. Just tell us a little bit about your day job. You're a relatively new voice around this table on a Sunday morning.
That's right. So we run a program on peace mediation at ETH Zurich. It's an executive program for diplomats. We have four governments as our partners: Switzerland, Germany, Finland, Sweden, and the United Nations. So it's an exciting program in peace mediation.
And this is, there's four participating nations, but are you also then bringing in diplomats from outside of those four as well? So if I happen to be a diplomat in Togo, can they also sign me up to go to ETH as well?
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the great things about our program, that it's really, really global. So half of our student cohort is from the quote unquote global South. So absolutely a very diverse student cohort.
Very good. Also, I believe Josh Fennert is standing by in London, our deputy editor. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Tyler. Good morning, everyone else. How am I sounding today? Last time I was on the show, you said it sounded like I was in a phone box.
You've improved from phone box. It sounds like you've maybe been investing in some Finnish cardboard and other paper supplies to insulate your little nest there. But it is an improvement, Josh. I think all of the listeners will be much, much happier. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in the UK. Maybe we can help dissect this question. I want to bring Rob in on this. Josh, why is it in the UK that when it comes to comms, when it comes to government comms, we have this 5-day lead-in? It seems very unique that, you know, we already heard on Thursday the Prime Minister is going to say this on Monday. Why doesn't the Prime Minister just say it on Thursday? Why don't they just call a press conference and get on with it, as opposed to actually creating, at a time when there's plenty of angst about, people just get stressed out all weekend. Of course, they're able to fill many column inches with speculation, but generally we know what's probably going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, it's a very funny situation and not orchestrated with a huge amount of control by the government. But as you and your guests will have seen, Tyler, there has been a journalist nominated to a new position of press secretary who's going to handle the number 10 daily press briefings as of next month. This is an attempt to get on top of the story and to control what's going on, because at the minute it feels like the government's reaction is a little bit outdated. They leak, as you say, a little bit of information a week beforehand to perhaps prepare people to, you know, poll the data, see what happens, and then they enact what happens afterwards. But people kind of knew it was going to happen. So, as you say, next week there's a 3-tier lockdown system being pioneered, being put out there by the PM, probably on Monday, and we already know about half of what's going to be in it. But crucially, we don't have a message from the government. We just have hearsay and tittle-tattle from the papers.
Rob, does this seem a little bit old hat on two fronts? I mean, one, just trotting out a press secretary now. I believe we've seen this not just in Washington, but elsewhere. So a little bit late to the party on that one. But maybe just the first question, though, what do you make of this approach to comms? As you said, this controlled leak, and then of course, you know, everything that happens at a public level, certainly amongst our journalistic brethren as well.
Well, I can't speak for Boris Johnson or number 10, but I can certainly say that there's a general dictum, which is bad policy is not going to be fixed by better communications or PR. And if you have bad policy to begin with or poor leadership, and I'm sure Boris Johnson, who knows Winston Churchill very well, I'm sure there's nothing in there that would in any of Churchill's writings that would give him some reason to act this way. But look, part of it is just weakness. You're afraid. You don't. It's like trial ballooning, right? You're not 100% sure people are going to respond. So you kind of let it get out through the media. Maybe you even get a positive response through the media by giving little bits and pieces. I mean, look, we all know that in journalism. Oh, you give me a little piece, I'm going to be more inclined to write something slightly more favorably because I get it first. So, I mean, but at the end of the day, if the policy is bad, it doesn't matter how good or bad your PR is. Mm. It's going to flop.
And I'm curious that with your program, on one side, you're talking to, of course, diplomats. But of course, we know every diplomat wants to be a digital diplomat these days as well. So when you look at mediation, and again, you've got the public pressure side. If something gets released first, and then you've got, of course, then the mobs, of course, pressuring for a little bit more or potentially or they want a little bit less. But how much does the public facing side really looking at the press impact also come into your day-to-day in the program?
It does, and it's one of the questions we look at continuously. And I think one of the most interesting aspects, if you think about mediation processes that are meant to be confidential, that are meant to be discreet. So what do you do when people nowadays have phones in their hands, they're tweeting as they're involved in peace talks? So how can a mediator manage that? And it's a tricky situation. There's no one size fits all answer to that. But of course, if confidentiality is jeopardized, you need to find other ways to ensure that confidentiality in a process. So you can have a no phones policy, or you have rather strict guidelines for what can you tweet about when you go online and tweet? Because usually also the rhetoric on Twitter is a little bit more harsh than it would be in an in-person meeting. Mm. So having those guidelines up front clarified is absolutely vital. And then it's a matter of confidence building to see to what extent do the parties stick to those guidelines. So if they do, you could say, even if it's rather harsh rhetoric out in the open on Twitter, it might bode well for the process. But if they really do not adhere to the guidelines, then you have some groundwork to do.
Chandra, you're also a big believer in no-phone policies as well. Just before we went on air, we were talking about, of course, digital diplomacy or lack of diplomacy that exists in hotels around the world. Josh, I want to bring you in on this as well. I'm wondering, should there be, because I think one actually a serious flashpoint, especially at a time when we have lockdowns happening around the world and you get all of these different nationalities compressed into one hotel and you really sort of see this could really kick off into a proper global conflict. So when I was in Greece last week, there was a near neighbor, lots of people from one country, not very far away, also in the midst of a very severe lockdown. Figure out who I'm talking about, listeners. And there was just no sense of respect at all. And you could just see the Swiss and other people who were there about to sort of fling a Birkenstock or something in that direction. And then, of course, we know that all of the Eastern Mediterranean could easily light up.
Yeah, I think it's an awful evolution also that we always have to think we have to share, first of all, immediately all what we do and everybody has to be part of it, or we don't even feel that we maybe disturb somebody, or that when you go in the tram in Zurich and somebody has the phone, you know, I would love to take the phone and throw it out because I, first of all, I'm not interested and I want my silence. And yeah, it's something that happened or happens in the last years, and I think it's not a nice evolution.
Josh, how is your... Your digital diplomacy document coming along. We've been thinking that there is a poster to be made, no?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And for the record, I'm in favour of flinging footwear if it'll help someone perhaps be a little bit quieter when they're conducting their extremely loud conversation with a loved one on public transport or in a restaurant. I think that's the right thing to do. A cork sole on the back of the head is sometimes the only way people will learn.
Yeah, or I was going to say maybe a big chunky Finnish clog as well. I mean, that you talk about sort of escalation. I mean, that's sort of like a Patriot missile battery. But Josh, aside from what we are not looking forward to out of number 10 on Monday, maybe a measure of the mood in the UK at the moment, at a time when we know that there's, of course, you know, also sort of these multi-levels of lockdown already happening. And of course, a patch that you're covering a lot is obviously the F&B sector in general. What are your restaurant and bar owning friends saying at the moment?
People are looking at a long winter of discontent, and while the Chancellor Rishi Sunak has been quite quick to offer slightly more money to people in lockdown areas, roughly a third of the UK with a concentration on the northeast, northwest and Midlands are still under a severe lockdown. The Chancellor has come back and said, you know what, I will support people when businesses just cannot open. But rather than to the 80% of their wages, it's going to be to around 66%, so two thirds of their wages. So there is a bit of a dialogue about how the government can support the hospitality industry. But an interesting thing that's happened that's receiving a big backlash in the papers this weekend and a lot of hand-wringing from the UK press was the announcement on Friday where Rishi Sunak said, you know, looking forward, some jobs are not going to be quote unquote viable. And since there's no package for the arts, there's no funding, there's no grants, there's an implication there that the UK government is deprioritising some jobs in hospitality and some jobs in the arts as, you know, non-essential bits of the economy, which I think is an extremely negative way to approach things. Obviously, the arts in the UK are a tremendous boon to the economy and a reason that people want to come to rainy, cold, old London to pursue their careers, to pursue their lives, and to go to the West End or to go to a great restaurant. So some concern in the media, but also some moves from the government perhaps to pony up a little bit of dough and show that the only reason the economy grew in the past few months, and it only grew 2% less than we expected, was because of hospitality, eating out and staycations. So hopefully we'll find a bit of a better balance moving forward.
We're going to go to the papers in a moment, Josh, and I want you to stick around as well, because the really fun part of the show is coming. That's, of course, where you give Chandra your wine briefing, and we're going to do that in about 2 or 3 minutes' time. But if you look at, you know, everything, German papers today, the Austrian press, and we're going to be in Vienna in a moment, there's, of course, a lot of discussion about really society dividing right now, and certainly, you know, dividing along lines of, you know, are we just, you know, really not sort of challenging government enough, and really sort of, you know, maybe sort of doubling down on issues of the economy, and saying the economy is just as important. We were talking to a policymaker in Zurich the other day, and they were saying that, you know, they're the lone voice in the room. This was someone who's in charge of economics, and he said the problem is, you know, as long as you've got the epidemiologists in the room, he said, you know, no one's listening, and so you were only sort of still leading on numbers and big data. Rob, I wanted to start with you, and I don't want to make it totally crystal ball hour, but where do you think we move right now? Because obviously numbers are skyrocketing everywhere. I mean, even you know, Switzerland put a quarantine now on Canada, and yet at the same time there is this sense in many places, if you can make a compelling argument in Switzerland as well that you need to go to the, you know, if you need to go to a country with high infection rates for 5 days and the meeting is not movable and it's business focused, you can go and do that trip.
Right.
So do you see that there's going to be more loopholes, that there is going to be sort of, you know, more sort of, you know, get out of jail cards as well, because there's this understanding, okay, we don't want masses moving around, but the economy still needs to move forward and we still need to meet face to face and do deals and sign contracts.
Well, I think certain governments are going to be more pragmatic. I would always look to the Swiss governments to be basically among them. You know, it will create a sort of Swiss cheese, if you will, with lots of loopholes and lots of legitimate ones that will help business, will help cultural and other exchanges. But it is becoming quite difficult. As you point out, I'm going to Munich this week, and all of a sudden I saw that Hamburg and Berlin, I think, were slapped on the list. I said, oh no, okay, well, okay, Munich's fine, but who knows by the time I'm there whether it changes. A friend of mine is in Venice, took his girlfriend to Venice this weekend. You know, the Veneto has now been put on. A friend of mine, Campania, like, the, you know, see, so it's really getting hard. It's not just countries. Canada, of course, being the one that surprised me, because, I mean, Canada has also been quite strict about letting people in. But, you know, we're going to get to a point where it's almost impossible to manage. And if, in fact, if you looked at, I mean, not, we get to the paper in a sec, but there's a piece in the Sonntag Zeitung today that talks about how the contact tracers here in Zurich are basically completely overwhelmed, and they're leaving it up to the infected to basically make sure that they're informing people that they might have been in contact. So you are getting this point where, I mean, it's going to be unmanageable.
Emily, do you look to anyone in terms of, from a leadership point of view, do we see that the way is, you know, is certainly being shown, that there, someone is revealing some type of light, you know, across the horizon right now when it comes to leadership? It's certainly in the issue of, yeah, living with this, while of course, you know, considering a vaccine and all of these other things, but literally saying we have 6 months ahead of us and we just need to figure out how we move on as a society.
Well, full disclosure, I'm 100% biased here, I would mention, of course, the Prime Minister Sanna Marin of Finland, as someone who has been absolutely clear from the outset in with her communications, for better or worse. And I think what I've appreciated, again, observing it from a little bit of a distance from Zurich, what I've appreciated about her is that she's made it clear from the beginning that they will commit mistakes. Everyone is learning how to deal with this pandemic in different ways. And again, as we go along, we will be committing mistakes, but we will hopefully learn from them. So that degree of honesty is something that I think has spoken to the Finnish people as well, as been witnessed in recent polls. But personally, I've liked that. So it's not someone who wants to sugarcoat that everything will be okay, things will be great and amazing, but rather things will be tough, but we will hopefully learn from this as well.
But it's curious. We've certainly seen over the last week another female leader, you know, in New Zealand, and there, of course, there's a bit of flag waving again. Look at, you know, we're a country, you know, with no infections right now, no cases right now, at least no reported cases. But where does that leave a country? So it's great to say we have no infections, but you're also New Zealand. I mean, you're already at the far end of the world. Your country is now closed down. That's great that you've got no numbers. But then what does that mean then moving forward? Because you still have to open up. Okay, yes, planes and boats can come in and trade. But it seems to be almost this sort of strange measure. We've got no cases. Look how good we are. Or there's the other side. Look at, you know, we're open, we're trading, you know, our economic numbers are upticking.
Yeah. No, I think you put your finger on it. So I think the better you do with handling the pandemic, the more pressure there is eventually and inevitably to open up the economy. And you see that in Finland. And of course, a lot of comparisons are made between Finland and Sweden, two rather different strategies. And even in Finland, you do see more and more pressure to open things up while handling the pandemic. So there are these two competing voices really pulling decision making in opposite directions. But at the same time, decision makers have to balance it. And tourism, you mentioned, is something that's also in the news in Finland. We don't have so many compared to other countries yet, especially northern Finland has been very, very greatly affected by the pandemic. The Brits are not coming in, the Chinese are not coming in. So how can you enable, create travel bubbles or something of that nature to enable them to come and visit?
I can see that Chandra has her pen at the ready. And so that means that, dear listeners, that this is, of course, the moment where our various correspondents and contributors and even newsreaders as well are going to offer up their maybe wine dilemma for a Sunday. Josh, we're going to start with you. Well, maybe just set the tone. What's the weather like? And what do you need either in the fridge or on the table by, I guess, 6-7 hours from now, maybe even 2 hours from now?
Well, I'm going to, with your permission, Tyler, change up the format a little bit, because I heard about a conundrum just before I came on air. And I think this person maybe needs a glass of wine more than me. Our producer for this show, Marcus Hippie, presenter of The Menu, longtime Monocle 24 presenter, said that he didn't have a very good night's sleep because he was pursued around his room by a mouse. And I hope that Chandra could maybe offer him a full-bodied autumnal red that'll help him sleep tonight, but
very
won't
good.
Make him miss his alarm for the globalist in
good.
The morning.
Does this sound good, Chandra?
Yeah, this sounds very good.
Okay. Rob, you were out looking for, I know, planters yesterday. You're sort of greening up the indoors with winter coming, etc. You're going tropical? What are you thinking this evening?
Well, I'll tell you, on Friday night, you saw me yesterday. I was a bit ropey, and I'm still a bit pickled from going to the hockey. I went to a hockey game here in Zurich, which was fantastic. Van Halen, beer, bratwurst. But I overdid it. But I will be, here's a question. I'm going to be in Munich a week from now, okay. And I'm going to be enjoying some sort of, you know, extraordinarily heavy German food, no doubt. What do I drink with that?
Instead of beer.
Instead of beef, okay. So like no good. Beer, but just good. Something good. That goes, I don't know, like a big sausagey pork knuckle something, whatever. Yeah.
is Emma Nelson standing by in London?
Absolutely. Chandra, it's lovely to have you here helping us today, because I think we're all slightly in need. Marcus and I were commiserating about the kind of last few days we've had. I must confess, I've had a bit of a week of it. My son was sent home from school to self-isolate because he'd been in contact with another child who had COVID. So we have spent the last 7 days combining working full-time with being full-time teachers. So I'm now the world's leading expert on map reading and long division. Chandra, two questions. Firstly, have you got something which can take the edge off the stress and boredom that my husband and I have been experiencing, but which allows us to fully function for 8 hours the next day? And secondly, another question. When is it acceptable to open a bottle of wine when you're homeschooling?
In the UK, let's say we stay in the UK.
We'll stick with the UK. I think we know the answer to that even. Okay. Emma, we'll come back to that in a moment. Okay, Emily, over to you.
I could actually give two options and then you can see if any of them is a good one. So one, I'm having brunch after this. I'm hopping on the train to Basel to see Fondation Baylor, the exhibition, for the first time. And then we're having brunch beforehand. And I have had too many mimosas for brunch during the lockdown. So something a bit more exciting would be great. And secondly, this evening, I'm inaugurating the fondue season for me. Anything, again, that I could have apart from the kind of medium range bottle from Coop, something else that you could recommend?
Good. And also to be purchased on a Sunday in Switzerland,
exactly.
just to add an extra dimension to that. Rob, but quickly, we're going to head back to London for the news shortly. But what stories have you picked up this morning? What have you got? A couple of things circled there on page.
Yeah, I have a couple of things. I mean, the thing that certainly caught my eye was this New York Times piece, The Swamp That Trump Built, which was a fantastic, sort of expose of all of the extraordinary businesses, his hotels in Florida and Washington have had, currying, you know, with people who are trying to curry favor with the government. That's fascinating because, of course, we're about to head into the election. So that's fascinating. But I also was looking at this piece in the Sunday NZZ, which said that basically all the hoteliers in Switzerland are freaking out. Now, we know that there's freaking out everywhere, but there's something in here that said that 2/3 of them have received COVID-related loans, and that some 10% of them are basically predicting bankruptcy. Just fascinating. You know, you see this. We are still in arguably the first part of the whole phase. We really haven't yet. That second, we're getting that resurgence. It's not really, we're not in the peak of what would be, you know, seen as a second wave. I think we're just beginning to see defaults and bankruptcies across the globe.
I mean, and it's incredible. We've seen over in Oerlikon that the Swiss Hotel, one of the sort of the mid-century icons, in a way you could say, which is, you know, was one of the, probably if not still the tallest hotel in Switzerland, gone.
And out of business.
Yeah. And now we across the border up in Frankfurt. I mean, probably the most important hotel, certainly during the Frankfurt Book Fair or any big messe, the Hessischer Hof, you know, also gone, deep pockets, etc. You know, when we look at this, you know, and I'm not sure what the NZZ are we talking about just shuttering and saying, look, we just got to ride this out, but we can't be sort of burning cash with staff, etc. And we will rejoin this program in progress when things kick off again.
I think in many cases, what you have are big hotel companies, the likes of Accor and people like that, which own the Swiss Hotel. I mean, I think they are just realizing that a good 20 to 30% of their business is going to go away. That's the hardcore business travel stuff that companies like yours and mine are going to basically shutter down. We're not going to do, if we're not going out to see client or doing a news related event or something like that, you can probably do it on through some other means. I know for a fact that, you know, many of these big hotel companies, spoken to the CEOs of a couple of them, they just are, it's that 20 to 30%. What are we going to do with it? Now, you could shut down the hotel and you could turn it into some other multi-use. Some companies like Accor, in fact, Sebastian Bazin, the CEO there, is talking about creating a sort of almost like a WeWork. So, you know, you take two or three floors of your hotel and you say, you know what, we're not going to have lodgers here. What we're going to have are people who are working within a 10 to 15 mile or, you know, kilometer radius from the hotel and don't want to be working from home. And we're just going to charge them a subscription fee the same way WeWork did. Now, whether this will work, because I don't think WeWork's really working, but I think this is the kind of thing they're having to be creative about. And that does mean that they're going to just close down some hotels for good. And I don't think they come back.
No. Emily, what have you spotted in the papers this morning? And we can have Helsing and Sonnemat. I mean, it's the world is open on a Sunday.
Great. No, I'll share one piece from the FT Weekend. I tried to find some news that might have a positive spin to them in the midst of all the doom and gloom of Corona. And this is, in fact, a news article on football clubs and how they've slashed their transfer spending. So the money they spend on buying players and transferring them to other clubs. And you might wonder, where's this positive spin? So I'll get to it in just a second. But the numbers have gone down. So apparently, for the first time since 2016, the global spending on transfers has fallen below 5 billion US dollars. So huge numbers, really beyond my brain capacity. But the interesting trend is to save money. Clubs are spending more on out-of-contract players. So not the big names, but rather the underdog. So I think this is the positive spin on it. So it's now the year for underdog football players to make it and show that they're worth the money, even if it's less money than a big name from a rival team.
And one story also, and we're going to go back to the news in London in a moment, is the NZZ. And it's a bit of a diplomacy story as well. It also has a Finnish spin to it. So just down the lake from here, I guess, you know, 20 or so kilometers in the little village of Stefa, there was a group of community-minded gentlemen, I believe, who felt that there should be a sauna. There should be a sauna on public land, and there was a disused changing facility, and so they went and they raised 300,000 francs. They gathered 500 signatures. This was enough to, of course, convince the town that maybe, of course, it would be okay to do some type of conversion process. And the Finnish ambassador, made the great trip from Bern up to Zurich yesterday to inaugurate this. Is this probably one of the great roles in Finnish diplomacy? Because we know a lot about sauna diplomacy. We've talked about it extensively at Monocle. But this is probably, would this be a high point in a diplomat's week if you're flying the Finnish flag?
Well, I would say this is sauna diplomacy at its best, absolutely. So, and then actually there's, we were talking about peace talks earlier in the program, and then how cell phones are a problem in today's world if you want to have confidential talks. So, of course, sauna is a venue where there's no technology. So there is, in fact, a history of sauna diplomacy. If you look at Finland's foreign service a few decades backwards, of course, there's some problematic aspects to it also if you look at it through a gender lens, for instance. But absolutely, I think this is great achievement, and then something I'm sure the MFA will be highlighting as well.
Very good. Emma, back to, of course, your listen, you could actually have, you know, that studio in London. Imagine if it wasn't wool-lined and if it was just, you know, done wonderful slatted wood. I mean, it would be transformational in the winter.
It would. Yeah, and right, let's work this through. This is going to be beautiful. I mean, for those of us who've never walked into our studio, Tyler, we must describe the fact that there is the most beautiful thick brown wool that lines the studio and makes everything acoustically glorious and very cozy as well. Would perhaps the engineers here at Monocle 24 might have something to say about the acoustics? We might be going a bit more Josh Fennett than Midori House. But also, I'm slightly wondered about when I start pouring a little steam on the coals, how that will affect the wiring. But I'm sure we can cope with it somehow. Plus, you know, radio, it doesn't matter what you're wearing, does it?
Let's have the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Donald Trump has made his first public appearance since being hospitalised by holding what he called a peaceful protest at the White House. His doctor says he's no longer a transmission risk for COVID. Armenia and Azerbaijan have both accused each other of violating the terms of a ceasefire in Nagorno-Karabakh less than 24 hours since a truce brokered by Russia was agreed. And many of the European news outlets this weekend are reporting the same story of a rise in the number of coronavirus cases. Austria's Die Presse asks if the country is ready for a second wave, especially when it comes to importing the right equipment to deal with it. And France's Journal du Dimanche has an exclusive appeal from 90 senior figures from the world of sport, medicine and business, calling for the reopening of the country's sporting events and facilities. Those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Back to you, Tyler, in Zurich.
Thanks very much, Emma. You mentioned Die Presse, and we are indeed heading a little bit eastbound. We're heading to Vienna right now to speak to the paper's editor-in-chief, Rainer Novak. Guten Morgen, Rainer.
Guten Morgen, Tyler.
Thank you very much for speaking to us. And I know that you're in a bit of an echoey space, and I was already told to advise our listeners that you've obviously moved into one of those enormous Viennese apartments that we all dream about that has multiple interconnecting rooms, and you probably only pay €1,000 a month for. But anyway.
You're absolutely right, but not €1,000, quite a little more, but yeah, you're right.
maybe we can start, if you could tell us what is on the front page of the paper. I know it, of course, it's municipal elections today in Vienna.
Yeah, we have election in Vienna. 1,100,000 people have to vote or allowed to vote today. And so that's our cover story. And we have a story that 17% to 18% of all Viennese inhabitants I'm not from Vienna by origin. They are all from the other states of Austria, so from Tyrol and Salzburg and Niederösterreich, which means they still not really, really Viennese people for the Viennese people, and tend to vote other parties, tend to be the better hipster and so on, yeah.
And how does that translate? What does that mean in terms of course, how you approach that as a paper? And you're talking about people, you know, they're Austrians, and you're not suddenly talking about, let's say, something which could be, of course, maybe a little bit more controversial, that these are more new Austrians, but you're talking about people from, of course, other states. How does Die Presse handle that story versus, let's say, your competitors?
It's not so. We're not doing it really honest. It's like some humor about those new Viennese people. For example, they really vote for the Green Party quite often, and they see themselves as the better Viennese people. So that's not really the really important, maybe not the most important story of today. Because the most important story of today is what will happen in Austria because of the COVID virus. Because during the election time, during the campaign, we all had the impression that the real big measures are not taken, and then the really hard decisions are not done because everybody's a little bit afraid that maybe the people would vote for another party, would vote for the right populist and so on, for the Freedom Party. So that was one reason why everybody in Vienna, let's say, was somehow ignoring the current situation.
If we look at the various parties, can you give us a view as to what are the, let's say, the particularly hot topics? Are there discussions around big infrastructure? I mean, obviously, you know, this notion of spend, and of course, how are we going to spend our way out of this? Has this been a focus? Because, of course, you know, Vienna is a city which consistently ranks as one of the most livable cities in the world. So I could imagine that most parties are somehow trying to play less traffic, more bicycles, more trams. But what is the picture look like if I'm sort of faced with a buffet of choices about this new, more livable Vienna? What do the various parties have on offer?
I mean, you know Vienna quite well, as I know. So I think it became different this time because of Corona. But you're right that the Green Party tries to tell people that we have new way of for cyclists and new. There was even a real public pool inside the city first time for the summer, which costed a lot of money and was really big in discussion, but somehow a point for the Green Party. But it doesn't matter what will happen today. At the end of this evening, we will have a red mayor, which means a social democratic mayor, because the party is still strong and keeps strong and will, I think they will increase today. So they had, let's say, about 40% at the last election 5 years ago, and now with a new candidate for mayor, they will have 42 or 43, which is also because of our world-famous Ibiza video, so that the Freedom Party, the right populist party from Heinz Christian Strache, they will lose a lot.
And just before we go, I'm curious if we can maybe look at politics on a federal level. You're talking about sort of numbers and certainly how well the mayor is going to do. How is Chancellor Kurz tracking right now in terms of approval ratings? Whether I'm in Vorarlberg or I'm in the heart of Vienna, how's the country feeling about his performance now?
I think he's doing well, but they have, as all governments in the world, I think before the summer it was quite a clear time to shut down a country, to shut down the economy. But now it's really highly complicated to deal with Corona. So he's not that good as it was used to be before the summer, but He's still in the lead in Austria, and I think there won't be any change of that. Huh?
Very good. Rainer Novak, editor-in-chief of Die Presse in Vienna. We're going to leave it there. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. We are back right after this.
The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 is brought to you in association with Longines. As part of this unique partnership, Longines bring you an exciting new show, The Spirit Lives On. The early 20th century was an era in which legendary aviators soared to new heights, performed daring stunts and tested the limits of air travel. They helped propel the development of aviation, powering its transformation into the innovative industry we recognize today.
It was such a wonderful age to fly through. I was privileged to know all those gallant pilots, both men and women, and gifted designers.
Fearless pilots like Amelia Earhart, Wiley Post, and Eleanor Smith were willing to put their own lives on the line to quench their thirst for adventure. In The Spirit Lives On, we tell the stories of these people who dared to live out their dreams in the air.
I flew the Atlantic because I wanted to. If that be what they call a woman's reason, make the most of it.
You can find the latest episode of The Spirit Lives On every Friday. Search for The Entrepreneurs on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at monocle.com to download or subscribe now. Longines, The Spirit Lives On.
And you're back with Monocle on Sunday. Just 10:42 here in Zurich, which means it must be time to cross to Bangkok. Our correspondent is there, Gwen Robinson. Sawadee kap. Good afternoon, Gwen.
Sawadee kap, Tyler.
Gwen, there's, of course, many things going on, but perhaps the main news, I think last time we spoke, I believe I saw the King's aircraft sitting at Zurich Airport. The King has is returning or has returned. And I know that there's right. I guess, considerable discussion because this is going to be quite a long stay for him as he escapes from Germany.
Well, indeed. But I knew you'd bring this up. He arrived at the weekend and after some absence and as I think people who follow this are aware, he rarely comes and usually just less than 20 hours, sometimes 18 hours. This time is a long one, a few weeks, and it does come against a backdrop of renewed protests. So it's all going to be very interesting in the next week. There's a national strike called and students are gathering on Wednesday. So much to digest in that.
But we don't see that the palace will be taking an active role or at least issuing some type of moderating tone, especially given that we're looking at national strikes and obviously a continued uptick in terms of protests from students.
Well, indeed, that's a very good question to ask because it's not clear at all how popular this call for a strike is. That's done by student protesters, and so far security forces and I presume the King, because they do heed his wishes, that have been very restrained. There's been almost no violence. Leaders have been arrested, but promptly fairly well let out on bail, and it's all been quite low key. I don't know if this takes it to another level and further challenges the patience of the palace, which is clearly very concerned. I mean, there's a lot of outpouring now that was unthinkable a year ago. And, as you know, there's increasingly some attention on what Germany itself is thinking about the continued stay of their rather controversial guest.
Mm. Gwen, let's just move to tourism. And of course, we always have to talk and take on this topic when we're mm-hmm. talking about Thailand. Depending, of course, on which international body you listen to, I believe the IMF have issued a report saying that of all the countries globally that are certainly hardest hit, Thailand is leading the way. I think actually Greece being number two, according to this report. Based on that, we've seen now, and we're talking at the top of the show, with Rob Cox about on one side there is a way around it business wise, and we've just seen Japan and Korea open up. Japan has opened up now, of course, with Singapore, with these special corridors, much more, you could say, to start with, much more business focused. And I'm wondering what are they saying in Bangkok at the moment?
It depends who you listen to. There's, as usual, the debate is as confusing as it ever was. We've heard there's on-again, off-again plans, and it was announced absolutely that Thailand would now go ahead with the first waves experimenting with what they call special visa tourists, which was supposed to begin with a bunch of Chinese tourists flying in direct to Phuket on October the 20th. That's now being delayed. We've heard it's now delayed till October 26th, but we're still not sure it's going ahead. That group includes business people as well as tourists. So it looks like, this special visa might include some business. The second wave is supposed to be from Scandinavian countries, including Denmark, in November. And already it seems the government or some parts of the government are backing away from it because they're concerned that Denmark's seen a recent spike. So, it's as clear as mud right now. But basically, as of today, the situation is Thailand is supposed to go ahead with an experimental group, 120 tourists, on about October the 26th. And the tourism minister himself said, if we can prove that we can bring tourists in with zero infections, this will calm local concerns and we can continue with the second wave. In other words, that the Scandinavian trip might depend on how the first one goes. The bottom line, of course, is Thailand is absolutely petrified of living with any kind of COVID infection news at all. So once, I think that's the country's making its own problem. Polls consistently show how worried Thais are about that.
And do you think that is legitimately the case when you speak to colleagues, when you speak to Thai friends as well? Is there this real fear, or is this you know, more of a government measure. That this is really something, of course, that the country's current leadership want to sort of use as a measure of success at a time when, of course, there are many question marks around other policies.
Well, let's say that one of their only outstanding successes has been the remarkably low rate of COVID infections, now about 3,600, and deaths are barely 60. Extraordinary, really, considering how dependent Thailand was on Chinese tourism, and particularly a whole big bunch from Wuhan at the beginning of the year. So you can understand the government being sensitive, but it is really extraordinary how even progressive, liberal and very, you know, otherwise very, you know, savvy Thais are extremely conservative. I mean, you can't even go into a convenience store still here without having to wear a mask. Otherwise, they won't let you in. There's a lot of places that insist on masks. And generally, I think attitudes are very... That's conditioning, I think. I think Thais have been convinced that, you know, you cannot live with this. So they watch aghast in Europe as, you know, countries are getting more relaxed. They're very bemused about Japan and Korea's move. So perhaps so seeing what other countries are doing regionally will relax them a bit. And if they do go ahead now with this experimental group and if it's successful, I think you could see an easing. Basically, also, as you say, you know, the economy is so reliant on tourism. And you would calculate that maybe one in every five Thai workers at least has some kind of connection to tourism. And I don't know if these are people being surveyed in the polls that show that 90% of Thais are against opening to foreigners, because I'm sure that a lot of people losing jobs in tourism would actually want borders open.
Probably agreed on all of that. Gwen, let's see how that test goes with the 120 inbound tourists.
Happy Chinese tourists.
Yeah, exactly. Gwen Robinson in Bangkok, we're going to leave it there. Rob, you're shuffling your papers over there. I see the Suntan's Exciting has popped up. Before we go back over to Chandra, anything else that caught your eye this weekend?
I mean, not in the Swiss papers.
You can go global. You can go Boston. You can go Vermont.
I have nothing. I didn't read the Burlington Free Press in Vermont, but I did. I was reading La Repubblica yesterday, the Italian paper, and it's just fascinating to see this. That we're talking about this resurgence. So, you know, I think there were 5,000 new cases in Italy. We had 1,500 cases, I believe, on Friday here in Switzerland. You know, but what's fascinating, though, is as you read through, there is just such a... It's so different from when we were looking at April, and we had these same numbers, 1,500, 5,000 in a day. And you see the number... I think the number of deaths in Italy was maybe 5. And here in Switzerland, we're still looking single digits almost any given day. And I'm starting to hear more and more anecdotal cases. So people I know, a friend in Rome, who someone in their company tested. And so now everyone's going to have to go out and get tested. And these are, you know, these are people who are kind of in the world that we generally inhabit. We have to get back out. You have to start seeing people in government agencies, people in businesses. And we are starting to see this increase. Even my company, we had in Zug, my office, which I haven't been to in a long time because it was closed, but still we have an email going around that lo and behold, somebody was close to somebody who had coronavirus. And so you have these massive tests going on. And what's just fascinating is you keep looking at the number of, I look at deaths per million and things like that, or hospitalized cases, they are quite low for the most part. I'm not saying that this should give us any sort of comfort necessarily, but it's not the same as when we were looking at things in April. And I think that we need to do a lot more understanding, have more understanding of these, how this data works. Mm.
And at the same time as well, maybe we the media too also have to change the narrative. There's not this focus on infections,
exactly,
but maybe the focus needs to be the headline numbers. Are hospitals burdened or not? Of course, we hear it, you know, in France and, of course, you know, some parts of Europe, it is getting challenging again. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as you said here, I mean, look at the NZ, did lots of papers in Switzerland just saying, you know, we're ready. I mean, everything is. And even at the worst of it last time, I mean, you talk to most doctors that we all know, and they were saying actually all of these wards were sitting empty here.
But what we're isolating those most vulnerable. I think that is happening now, and so in many cases, what we're seeing are just the people. We're going to have to learn to live with this virus. That means lots of testing. That means you know, infection rates that may be higher among younger people who are actually not going to have any any of the symptoms, or may very few of them.
Indeed. We have a lot of bottles to get through as we head towards the end of the program. Chandra is standing by. I mean, maybe, Emily, we'll start with you. You gave Chandra a number of different challenges. I mean, first, you're on your way to Basel right now to go to the Baylor. You're having your first fondue of the season. And also, as you said, you don't want just sort of a mid-range wine. You want maybe something which is a little bit more upmarket, still with the challenge, of course, that it is Sunday. Not everything's open in Switzerland. And you still have to, of course, procure this sometime over the next 6 or 7 hours.
That's right. Sorry about the difficulty of the challenge.
No, perfect. It's, anyway, general, it's a very challenging selection for this Sunday. So if you go a brunch and you say you don't like so much you had too many mimosas already, there's not the same style of wine, but what is always good is a Moscato d'Asti. You know, it's low in alcohol, and I think if you do brunch, you don't increase to high alcohol levels, so start low. Moscato d'Asti, nicely chilled, and the famous and very good one, which I always have chilled ready, is from Saracco. So this is I could recommend very, very good. Then the fondue, you don't want the general wines we drink with fondue. And what do we drink? We drink fondant at Chasselas, or maybe if you really want to go another way, try a red wine. And Humanier Rouge, also from the Valais, it's not too heavy, and you drink it like slightly chilled, and it will go very well with the cheese dish, with the fondue.
Sounds perfect. Never had red with fondue, so no, that's great.
You will also make a good impression if you come with this idea.
Okay, very good. Josh, you set a challenge for our Marcus Hippie, who did not sleep well but needs to sleep well last night. He still has to function as a producer next week as well, correct?
Oh, this might be a problem. Okay, because there is one wine that has also the subtitle, like the meditation wine, and I cannot really drink this wine, or I cannot drink too much because it really knocks you out. And this is the Amarone. Amarone is always a little bit higher in alcohol, and you know it's produced out of dried grapes, and it puts you first in a relaxing state, in a comforting state, and you will deeply sleep after even three glasses.
Josh, what do you think of that? Are you happy with that?
I'm more than happy with that. If it does half of what you've said it does on the tin, then Marcus Hippie and myself would be extremely happy. What a recommendation.
A bottle is enough for two. You will both sleep.
I'm also sort of wondering, we've also got Emily here as well. Do you think sort of Finns, and I'm not sort of playing to national stereotypes, but I mean, of course, you know, you played to your prime minister. You could have sort of, you know, talked about lots of other countries. So you did set yourself up for that. Do you think Finns might also have sort of, you know, a different genetic reaction to maybe an Amarone as well? Will it really knock a Finn out, do you think?
Well, let's hope so. We'll need to quiz Marcus in a couple of days to see if he's still asleep or
he's still with us at that point. Josh, I mean, of course, if we sort of look at London, I just want to go back because you're very, very good at sort of covering the wine scene. If you had to go and buy, we're talking about an Amarone right now. What's the wine shop of choice in London right now, at least for you, and especially through these times? Have we seen? You know, of course, we've heard about wine consumption certainly holding up. Who's doing a great job in terms of purveying good bottles right now?
Oh, that's a very good question. And there are lots of people doing really well because, as you'll know, fewer people going to restaurants and paying a slight premium for their wine. People are actually spending a lot more over the counter on wine. And just a personal favourite of mine, because it's actually not too far from my house, is a little place in East London called Newcomer Wines, which deals exclusively with natural wines from Austria, a country that was very early to get rid of lots of the pesticides and processes after a bit of a scandal, admittedly.
I think it was antifreeze, wasn't it?
They were putting antifreeze in. They were making the wine very sweet, but not very good for you. But these guys show a lot of a huge area under vine where they're trying to do things naturally well. And crucially, they don't smell or taste too much like a farmyard, which is a bit of a pitfall of some natural wines.
Yeah, as Chandra has many views on some of them. Chandra, what is your, when you talk about some of these natural wines, we're really sort of...
Well, I think a very important thought is that every generation needs to do the wine they think it's the best. And I think this movement is a little bit the younger generation. And what they do and what is good about it, they think about the planet, maybe less about the taste of the wine. And I think, you know, you have positive points for both sides.
Now, Rob gave you a challenge as well. He's off to Bavaria, at least we hope he's off to Bavaria without quarantines. He wants to have all of the delights of Oktoberfest, but he wants to do it without beer.
You know, I'm totally in Bavaria mode because I saw on Netflix the series, what was it, Oktoberfest, Blood and Beer or something. It was very intense and a lot of blood and beer indeed. And of course, beer is the main drink, but with a little bit heavy sausagey food, wine that always goes very well is Pinot Noir. And Germany has a very strong and good culture of Pinot Noir. Even we speak more about the Riesling wines, but you have good Pinot Noirs. And the Ahr Valley is always a secret place where, for example, Family Meyer and Neckel has very nice and a safe brand. If you want to go for a brand for a Pinot Noir from Germany, you take from Fürst. Family Fürst, you are always safe.
Okay, thanks.
And don't drink it a little bit chilled, always a little bit chilled.
And what about Amarone? Would that go with it?
Oh, you
guys got me really thirsty.
No, I know.
No. This will not work. You know, okay. you have the intense, heavy food and the wine. This will not work.
Okay, perfect.
We're going to have to leave it there, everyone. My thanks to Chandra Kurt, of course, for all of her tips. Rob Cox, also Emily Isaho. And of course, to our other contributors from around the world, Gwen Robinson in Bangkok, Josh Fenner in London, and Rainer Novak from Die Presse in Vienna. Our producer today was Marcus Hippio. Studio manager in Zurich here has been Desiree Venley. And of course, Nora Hall in London. I'm Tyler Brulé here in Zurich. I'm around for most of this week. This has been Monocle on Sunday. Have a very good weekend. Goodbye.